You are listening to The Mauer Report, a live radio show that ventures into the mysteries of life, as well as the hot topics of the day, either political or business.
Well, welcome everybody to The Mauer Report. I hope you're all doing well. I know it's been a wild couple months, couple weeks, year. I don't know anymore. It seems like yesterday I was just doing a show and it's been a week, so I don't know anymore what is going on. But before I forget, we got to go over to 86 The Struggle, which is Andrew Goldsite. We're helping restaurant workers. I've seen all the traffic that's come through my site to him. I hope it's all paying off for him. I'm glad you guys are taking an interest in that, supporting these restaurant workers, supporting him through this. They've raised over $300,000, and he's paid it all out, and he's raising more. He wants to raise $1 million, and I think, well, I know us as Mauer Report listeners probably aren't going to get him there. I have big goals for this month, but, you know, but I just want you to go over and check it out, and worst case, go order some takeout from a restaurant that you haven't been to in a while, because we got to keep that industry alive. But not exactly why we're here tonight, but, well, you'll see the segue here in a minute. I want to welcome, I'm just gonna throw it this way. Are you still wrestling? I shouldn't say former if you're still wrestling.
I am still wrestling. You know, we could get into that. I've never really stopped, but unless you were living in northern New Jersey, probably within a half hour to an hour radius of my home, you probably haven't seen me in quite some time.
So, WCW Crowbar. I'm not going to, if you need to know who he is, you need to go to Google and find out. Is that fair? Well, you've been everywhere, man. We'll get into that through the course of this, but how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me on, man.
So before all my traditional listeners say, oh, a wrestler, stay with us, because this story, we're going to get some places that you, we're not going to talk specific matches. We're going to kind of build the career, and this guy works. And I mean works a lot. So we're going to get into how he manages all that. So first, are you insane?
No, that's all relative. Some people may say so. I think I'm insane. Possibly that I take on a lot of things. Some people tend to call me a workaholic, but I engage in a lot of things that I have a passion for and that I enjoy. So some people think that I set a schedule for myself that is insane, but no, I don't think so. It's just normal to me.
I kind of have that same, just keep moving every day until you just can't move it anymore. So I understand that. So that's why I appreciate what you're doing. So let's go back though. Take me back to what made you want to become a wrestler way back in the day.
I remember my earliest memories being in my house with my brother that was 10 years older than me, my dad, both wrestling fans, and we lived in a little Cape Cod in a small town in New Jersey, and I would remember them, at that time wrestling was on late at night, and I would remember them staying up to watch it, and my bedroom was kind of diagonal from the living room, so I would be put to bed, and I would slowly get out of the covers and kind of squirm towards the foot of the bed where I could see diagonally into the living room, and I would watch it from that angle even though I wasn't supposed to be up. So that was my earliest memories of sneak watching wrestling. And as I got older and I was allowed to stay up more and more, and there was more Saturday morning wrestling here or there, I just became a huge fan, and it just grew on from there.
But for the people out there who aren't wrestling nerds, wrestling has evolved quite a bit since those days. So,
Very much so, yeah.
As I say, so the original draw was what? Because it wasn't Flash and Pyro and guys, I mean, it was just the actual sport that drew you.
You had guys walking out of a curtain, maybe, or even an arena door, and you had some smoky arena lighting, you had some cool characters, a lot of interviews, but it, you know, everything that's going on today is awesome, but it was just bare bones wrestling, athleticism, some cool characters, and those guys somehow just managed to suck me in as a kid, and it was I was captivated by what I watched.
So let's fast forward the tape a little bit. So you've been a fan for a while. You probably go and see them in person a little bit, and then you decide to actually do it.
Absolutely.
How did that transition start?
As I'm getting older and older, I'm becoming a bigger and bigger fan, and it gets to the point where I'm starting to realize when I start hitting 13, 14, being a fan's not enough, that I might want to do this. And I had no idea on how to do it. At that time, you would buy the wrestling magazines. You would see an occasional article about the Monster Factory, but there weren't a lot of schools. Now there's schools all over the place. If you want to find a wrestling school, you can find one today. They were few far in between, and they're often far away. I can't get into the whole particulars, but through a friend of a friend, there was a guy that owned a bicycle shop one town over from me. The guy's name was Tom Rumsby, an independent promoter. And this friend of a friend knew him, and he somehow caught wind that he was planning on opening up a wrestling school in about a year and a half with Iron Mike Sharp. And he shared this with me, and I was probably 15 and a half, maybe 16 at the time. I walked about a mile and a half, 2 miles to this bicycle shop, met with the guy. He told me his plans, that he was going to open up a school with Mike Sharp. And I left there knowing that that was going to happen. I was going to find a way to make that happen. So I had already worked as a teenager, mowing lawns here or there. I started doing more lawn mowing accounts. This was before I could drive, so I would walk around the neighborhood with my lawnmower and weed whacker over my shoulder, and I would do lawns. And I also, that summer, picked up a job in a local catering hall, and I worked Friday, Saturday, Sunday, double shifts, and I earned the money that I would need to go to Iron Mike Sharp's wrestling school. And when I, just before my 17th birthday, I started out there.
Okay, so I actually had Iron Mike Sharp on my notes because I told a couple of my listeners I had you on, or going to have you on tonight, especially, you know, the type of people I said that this show wouldn't be geared to, but they wanted me to ask you about him because he has some interesting stories floating around the room.
It's all true. Great guy. It's all true. Go ahead, ask away.
I was going to say, do you have one in particular that stands out to you, well, that happened to you or around you?
Well, at the time, as a new student, I didn't think twice about it. But now if you go to wrestling school, you usually wear maybe shorts or sweats and a T-shirt, maybe some long tights and a T-shirt or a tank top. Mike trained us, and he came out to train like he was going out there for the first match at the Garden. Black trunks, black boots. Occasionally he wouldn't, but he usually had the forearm brace on, and he oiled up, and he trained us like he was having a match at the Garden. He wore his full gear when he trained us, and now that seems strange. At the time, I didn't think twice about it because that was the only Mike Sharp that I knew from the television and shows and stuff like that. But now I'm like, wow, Mike was really into his stuff, you know.
Well, that sounds like a good match for you, though, because you sound like that intense young man who wants to be in there, mixing it up with him.
Sure. Yep. And just meticulously neat. He had a big hockey bag with all of his stuff in it: tights, underwear, toiletries, boots, whatever. But inside that hockey bag were a plethora of giant Ziploc bags. And each thing was, everything had its own spot inside of a bag, inside of the big bag. So it was almost like one of those Russian egg dolls. He would open up his bag, and then inside the bag was a series of smaller bags and smaller bags, and everything was ultra organized.
Man, I am not that guy.
No, I'm lucky to get me stuff. Neither, not even.
I'm lucky to get stuff in a bag.
Yeah.
I wish I was. I wish I could be more organized. Yeah. As I look at my desk, I mean, I seriously wish that I could be more organized. So you go for
Hey, they say geniuses are messy, they say, so. You know, don't feel bad.
I'm not going to argue that. So, okay, so you do the school, and then where do you end up? Where does this road take you?
I start doing shows at his school, and at that time, it's just amazing. You know, like, I'm actually doing a wrestling show, and I have the VHS tapes here, and I'll pop them in, and I was so bad. We were all so bad, and the matches would go on for, like, 20, 25 minutes, because everybody would do a match, and everybody would want to try out all the stuff that they learned. So you had a bunch of matches that looked almost identical, and just guys wearing different outfits. But a cool thing that I can note is at that time, my first match and my first, I guess we call it, feud for the Iron Mike Sharp School fans was against Big John the Lumberjack, a.k.a. Jerry Toot, who later became known as The Wall in WCW, and Malice in TNA. So it was kind of cool that we started there together, and then fast forward years later, we're having this feud on WCW, and he's thrown me off sides of Trons and through announce tables and all this stuff. So it really was a cool full circle moment where we started out at that school, horrible wrestlers doing horrible matches, and we ended up somehow in one of the biggest companies in the world working against each other, and we were great friends. So it was, as I said, a full circle moment, very sentimental, really, really cool. And I'll never forget that. You know, that's kind of, you know, that was, happened at first at Mike Sharp's, and then slowly we start to break out and get real independent shows.
Yeah, I was going to say, so then you start climbing the proverbial ladder, but I don't know if it's a ladder as much as I'm saying it is. It's kind of a bottom, and then there's the brands across the top that most people know.
Sure.
Yep, I mean, I guess there's smaller companies. There's mid-range people in there, though, I guess.
At that time, there were a handful of really big independent companies in the Northeast where they would draw between 6 and 1,000 per show, and they would have name guys on there, and they would run regularly. And we always tried to get on those shows, and when we were first breaking in, there would be a bunch of new guys, bunch of students. We'd all pile in a car, whoever it was. We'd all pitch in for gas, and we would all show up at these shows, whether we booked or not, and hoping for an opportunity to get a preliminary match, or if somebody got injured or they got caught in traffic or they couldn't make it to the shows, that we would be available to get on that show. And if not that, at the very least, get to meet the promoter, meet the other wrestlers, hand them your 8x10s. At that time, that's what you did. You brought your 8x10. Everybody had their 8x10s. And
I was just sitting here thinking about that as you're going around. How are you marketing this? How's this?
Yeah,
I mean, it's all
8x10.
Go ahead.
It's 8x10s and videotapes. And if you wanted a good videotape, you had to invest in 2 VCRs and learn how to splice your footage, you know, with a VCR. So, you know, they were very basic, rough cut tapes, and we would bring those around in 8x10s.
So when was the first, I'm going to use the big air quotes here, apologize, break?
Sure.
In your wrestling career?
My first break was when Dennis Carluzzo put me in the NWA heavyweight tournament when he ran that. And I worked with Tracy Smothers in the first round. Also around that time, Dennis took a liking to me very much, and around that time I got to work with the likes of Chris Candido, Al Snow, and then eventually Sabu. And I always thank the guy. Sabu led a young kid. I was probably 19 or 20 at the time. He let me shine. He let me do all this wild stuff that I had been practicing. We had a series of a few, like, really wild matches for that time, for that era. And through those matches, they caught wind of me at WCW, and Kevin Sullivan brought me in to work with Conan on Nitro. And that was the really first big break.
Yeah, I was going to say, you mentioned El Snow and Sabu. Now, see, I told you this, I'm from Western Pennsylvania. So you mentioned this is where I this gets a little fun for me. Barely. No, I'm just kidding. It actually was because back in the day, we used to get those ECW shows.
Sure.
Like at midnight, right, yeah, on Saturday nights. So,
absolutely.
I mean, that's where, I mean, I enjoy, I mean, those, in my mind, now you can tell me if I'm wrong, but those ECW shows from like 95 to 2000 were pretty good. Like, they were coming pretty hard. And that was right about, I mean, the Monday Night War started in there too, but those ECW shows felt a lot cleaner, and I mean, not necessarily cleaner because there was blood everywhere. Maybe that's not the best way to describe this, but better produced, like for actual wrestling content.
Absolutely. There was something very special about them. And, you know, I always say that it's not fashionable in pro wrestling to admit that you're a huge fan of the game. I got into pro wrestling because I was a huge fan. And I'll say to this day, I'm probably the biggest fan going of all kinds of different wrestling and stuff like that. But ECW at that time was putting on a product that, although I was involved in the business, I was a fan. I made it a point to catch their show, not just as a professional to stay proficient with a style that was happening and what was going on and what moves talents did, but I stayed watching it because I was a huge fan of the style, the product, the cutting edge nature of it. And that right from the get go sucked me right in as well.
So let's jump off this back train and we'll get back to it. Germantown Runner has a question for you that I want to ask because it's interesting and it ties right to where we're at. Will professional wrestling continue to grow new fans and internationally?
I don't know. I don't know. I see wrestling now, it's there's so many genres. You know, if you go through the independents, you got your GCWs, you got your deathmatch stuff. There's still a handful of family-friendly crowds. You got Ring of Honor doing their more pure wrestling. You got AEW there doing their style, WWE doing their style. And they all have their fans. They all have their fans that are passionate about it and check it out. I don't know if you're ever going to get that kind of product where it's just a massive crossover into pop culture where everybody is into it the way it was. I would love to see it happen, but I don't think it needs to happen. If it happened, it would be fantastic. I think it'd be great for wrestling if we had that crossover pop culture. Everybody's watching wrestling. Everybody is enthusiastic. Everybody's passionate about it. That would be awesome. But even if it doesn't, I think each genre, if you will, of wrestling will always have its core fan base. They'll always have those fans that will watch it. And they'll always exist. And they'll always do well or okay enough to be profitable. You don't need to have, while it's great to shoot for, I'm sure, a crossover pop culture product, because that's going to bring more viewers, more merchandise, more everything else. You could still have a profitable, sustainable business with a smaller crowd. I think so much pressure, so much emphasis is put on trying to get wrestling back to where it was, where we had that big boom. And again, that would be awesome. Whether it happens or not, who knows? But it doesn't need to get there. You could still have a profitable, sustainable product without reaching those numbers.
And I'm sitting here thinking, is that why the WWE is kind of slipping? Because they try too hard to bring up the next Steve Austin or Rock or whoever. Like, it just feels like they're always trying to force somebody to be that next one.
And I'm a realist, too. That may not happen for another 5, 10, 15 years. It may never happen again, but it doesn't mean you can't have a financially successful product, a sustainable product that keeps the networks happy, gets your talent paid, and it makes your shareholders happy, or if it's a privately owned company, is still, you know, profitable for you. Does that make sense or no?
Yeah, it makes plenty of sense because, I mean, profitable is profitable for a business. I mean,
sure. Yeah.
So at what point do you pick up the actual career, though, in this process? When do you start becoming a physical therapy?
Real funny story. So I think the end of my junior year, I had my meeting with my high school guidance counselor. And she goes, Chris, what do you see yourself doing? What do you want to do? I go, well, I want to wrestle professionally, and I want to be a physical therapist. This lady looked at me like I had about five heads and worms crawling out of my ears.
I can imagine. I mean, yeah.
And I understand that look that she gave me because I would probably, I understand it. It's very far-fetched. But I've always been focused. I've always been driven, and I like having goals. I like having things to shoot for. I'm the kind of I've had people tell me that I can't do things my entire life. And I always use that as fuel. So I went to school at that time, and even now to this day, physical therapy school is extremely competitive to get into. I went to Kane University in New Jersey, and you went to the school, but in order to get accepted into the program, you had to apply for that major. You actually had to apply for the major. The year that I applied, they got like 2,000 and something applications, and they accepted 32, and I just happened to make it in there. I basically went to school during the week. I lifted weights at night. I watched wrestling often. I've studied wrestling often, and I wrestled independence on the weekends, and I had no social life. I was all in pursuing two things that I wanted more than anything on the planet. And I was able to sacrifice with the social life and all the with the fun things that a lot of college age, you know, kids have at that time, just because I wanted these two things that badly.
Now, you'll have to forgive this question, but I mean, we were just talking about ECW a few minutes ago, and that was kind of extreme, and you're talking about being a physical therapist, and I could see these paths crossing for obvious reasons, but because that, it, I mean, wrestling is not an easy sport on the body, I guess is where I'm headed.
No.
Go ahead.
Definitely, the background in physical therapy has enabled me to nip a lot of problems in the bud that, you know, and it's enabled me to have this longevity, you know, that along with once WCW ended, I made the conscientious decision that I saw the landscape. I had a few dark matches for WWE, got a great reaction. I'm not a delusional guy. I got to wrestle at the Garden against El Gran Apollo, got a great reaction, and there were many people, many insiders saying this guy's definitely going to get signed, and it just didn't happen. And at that time, all ECW was bought by WWE, WCW bought by WWE, and there was a logjam of just talent trying to get up there, and I just had the foresight to see that the likelihood of getting in that door with all this talent trying to get in that little opening wasn't going to happen. So I transitioned into normal life, and I made the conscientious decision that I was going to be a full-time physical therapist. I was still going to continue to wrestle on weekends locally because I freaking love this stuff still, and I still do. And but as a result of that, I was wrestling twice a month, maybe three times a month, whereas there were a lot of guys trying to get noticed, trying to get through, get noticed to be signed by WWE. And they were working Friday, Saturday, Sunday, sometimes double shots every single week. And when you do stuff like that, your body takes a lot of wear and tear. I wrestled enough to quench my thirst for something that I was very passionate in. I still wrestled hard. I still wrestled a few times a month, but I assumed a wrestling schedule that was a lot less than most others.
So I've got to ask, and I know this probably did happen, but I'm going to ask. So you got settled in, living the normal life, and did any opportunities come and knocking that made you at least try to have that thought of maybe doing it again, full run?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've been doing it the whole time, but when TNA started, I was actually part of the first two or three pay-per-views. They had me in there as a member of James Mitchell's new church. It was me, Malice, Slash, and I thought we had a pretty cool look. We had a real funky look there going. We looked evil. We looked mean. But at that time, they were running out of Nashville, and I had gotten a call, and I was told, we really need you to move down here if you want to be part of the company. We can't afford to fly in. And at that time, I knew they were flying in other talents. And it kind of told me that I'm not as valuable to the company if they're not willing to fly me in. If I was single and I had nothing tying me down, I might have moved down there.
Oh, you would have. Don't even say might have.
But
if you were a single guy, you would have been there.
But at that time, I was engaged. I had just purchased a house. I just got a job as a administrator for a huge healthcare company called Health South at the time. It was called Health South. And I described that moment to a lot of people. That was my first real tough, for lack of a better word, adult decision where Chris Ford, who loves wrestling, I love performing, I love getting out there, I saw an opportunity of a new growing company with TNA, but I also saw that my value with them may not have been what I thought it should be. I had to make the adult decision and say, I can't do that. I have a house. I'm getting married. I have a good job here, and I can't go. And it was a tough decision to make. But it's a decision that I'm happy that I made, and in hindsight, it was the right decision.
Well, yeah, I think everything's turned out okay for you so far.
Yeah, thank God. Yes.
So you mentioned lifting weights earlier, and I got another question earlier from one of my, actually Chris, the guy who does my show notes. I should give him mad credit. He puts up sure. Listening to this show all the time, so he needs some credit. I know. He wants me to ask you about what type of workout routine you do, because he's wondering about like high endurance, like a football player, or more bodybuilding, the overall conditioning versus that. And he also wanted me to ask you if you've done any kind of like gymnastics aerial training in there.
Gotcha. So I use the tagline these days, timeless.
Yes.
It takes worse to do the timeless thing. As you get older, you have more wear and tear on your joints, on your body, and I've morphed my workout over the years to accommodate any kinds of aches or pains or anything else that I may have acquired from wrestling or just the natural aging process. I'm 46. I still work out hard, but I work out smart. I'm not a fan at any age of high impact, explosive weights. It's kind of hard to explain on an interview, but force is mass times acceleration. The mass is always going to be the same. It's the weight you're lifting, be it 5 pounds, 10 pounds, 15 pounds. If you lift that weight in a slow fashion, you move from point A to point B. If you add explosion, if you add speed, that's acceleration. you increase the force, and the force doesn't go to your muscle fibers. It's going to your tendons. And I think that's why we have so many issues with guys with tendonitis or tendon ruptures, ripping things off with the bone. A huge, and I'm not just saying this because he's one of my favorite guys, a huge part of my wellness and well-being since about, I'm trying to think when it was, maybe 2005 or six, is DDP yoga. I got to this when it was called YRG, yoga for regular guys and girls. And I utilize that for flexibility. I do a lot of low impact cardio. I still do weights, but I do slow, controlled repetitions. I avoid explosive stuff. That being said, I try to be explosive when I wrestle, and I try to go all out when I wrestle. So I try to minimize my wear and tear and save all the wear and tear for ring time. You know what I mean? And during my regular daily workouts, I try to get the job done. I try to get the physical benefit without the collateral damage that could come from working out improperly.
That's funny that you mentioned that, because you mentioned these tinnitus and these, or not tinnitus.
Tendonitis.
Tinnitus is a whole different problem. I see the clip of Tiger Woods saying, somebody asked him what the one regret of his career was. He said he ran too much, and that broke his body down.
Wear and tear. It's all impact, you know? I explain it to my patients. I'm sorry.
No.
When you run, when you jog, there's a clear cardiovascular benefit. You're working your heart, your lungs, you're working your cardiovascular system. Undeniable. That's great. But while you're doing that, the collateral damage is on your bones and joints. So while you're benefiting yourself with the running, with the jogging, you're putting a lot of wear and tear on your ankles, your knees, your hips, your spine. I choose for my cardio, I ride a stationary bike, but I ride it at a very high intensity so there's no impact, but I'm also not doing a leisurely ride. I'm grinding out some hard revolutions at a high level, but I'm saving my body that wear and tear of the pounding on concrete or on a track or on grass, whatever.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. So I you mentioned DDP, and I'm not a big name dropper. You can, trust me. You can drop all the names you want. But I seen the documentary, what was the name of it, with him and Jake Roberts about the yoga and how it changed, I mean, literally changed their lives. And that's phenomenal. To think about how something that kind of got, misbranded, I guess is the easiest way to put that, has worked so well for them.
Sure. It is and has been a regular part of my training regimen for almost 20 years now. And whenever I speak to him or text him or IM him, whatever, I always let him know. I go, I'm able to do the things that I'm able to do, largely in part because of your program. It's fantastic. It's a safe program. It's low impact, and it's one of my regular go-tos weekly, multiple times a week. It's a huge part of being timeless.
You've mentioned that. Did you? You sent me a video the other day. Have you posted that yet? I should know this. But
which one?
Whichever one you sent me. Did you post that yet?
I believe I have. If it was one with the clips and all the interviews, there's you were up around. I think something like 16,000 views, which for some that's not a big deal, but for somebody like me, very late to the Twitter game, extremely late to the Twitter game, it's kind of cool. So
let's back up the boat for a minute, because you sent me this a couple days before you posted it, and you asked my thoughts of it, and I watched it. And
sure.
I'm blown away. It's well, really well done. And then I ask, who did that for you? Because I'm always looking, because it's hard when you're doing audio to convert that to video and make something pop.
Sure.
And you said you did it. And I mean, I guess yeah. Not hearing you going back to the VHS days, VCR days, it makes a little sense, but the gap of technology, I mean, have you always had the passion to, I mean, I guess you've always had to kind of sell yourself.
I always had to sell myself. What happened there, and again, to bring up Dallas, if you read his book, Positively Page, and I actually used this quote last night when I was, he actually retweeted it and he commented on the video and he said, great job. You did a lot of good work. I said, well, during COVID, I learned a new skill. I learned a new trade. I turned a negative into a positive, and that's one of his sayings. There's a great group around New Jersey called GoPro Wrestling. They do a lot of filming for a lot of the wrestlers. They filmed some of the footage, the vignette, the footage from that clip. They do phenomenal work. They're great guys. They're easily accessible, but if you know my personality, I might come up with an idea and I got to run with it. And I can't wait for, let's set up this meeting and let's film this. Let's film this. It's great to have that. And they do awesome, awesome work. But I came up with this whole timeless character idea during lockdown, during quarantine, whatever you want to call it. And I would come up with an idea and I had to act on it immediately. So I learned with the video editing on an app. I had a crash course tutorial from Twitter madman, actually social media madman, Robert Frank, the guy that does the gym videos. He's hysterical. He's a New Jersey guy, but he gave me a crash course in editing over the phone. Took time out of his schedule to teach me, and then I got the basics from him, and I just put in a lot of time, and I learned it in my spare time. If I had a few minutes here or there, I would toy around with this. I learned a lot of my editing on the toilet. I hate to say you have spare time when you're sitting there, and I'll bring up the editing app and say, let me see what I could do here. And fast forward to last week, and that's probably the most involved piece that I've made so far.
Well, from the shitter to 16,000.
Exactly.
No, but that,
that's a hell of a book title, isn't it?
Yeah, I was going to say, you could have that one. no, it. I mean, but that, I mean, I get, you know, people, I've been kind of trying to figure out what this COVID means for individual people, and you just hit it. You learned how to edit videos and you're doing great things, Dory. Like, there's a lot of things that, while we all complain about the mask and all these other things, there are finite moments for some people. Not everybody's having these opportunities to take advantage of it. So that's interesting to hear that you did.
And it was work, but as I said before, huge fan of this, very passionate about this business, love all aspects of it. So it was putting in work, but it was work involving something that I loved, and that as I learned the skill more and more, I was able to transfer that skill into these videos that I was able to communicate and participate in this great business when there wasn't a lot of wrestling going on. So it was a really great thing. You turn a negative into a positive.
You have to. Okay, so you got to settle a bet for me.
Go ahead.
I'm waving hello to Captain Canada in my chat room because he put this out there. We have a
all
little
right,
wager.
Captain Canada.
We have a little wager. So who is the toughest man in wrestling?
I got to go with Mang. Just from what I've heard, what I've seen, I'd say Mang.
I'm sorry. What'd you say? You didn't say. You didn't. That's what he said. Dang it! No, I should have told you that beforehand and set
and
you up.
Also, too, if. He likes you. I mean, he's always been super, super great to me and just a super sweetheart of a guy. But just going by the stories I hear, I wouldn't want to piss him off.
So, I've like I said, I figured you would go like a Mick Foley or Terry Funk on me, go old school.
What'd you say? I'm sorry.
I figured you'd go Mick Foley or Terry Funk or somebody old school.
I don't know if we were talking like real fights or something like that.
Well, no, I asked the question. That's fine. Okay. I mean, that's how the question was.
Oh, Mick Foley, Terry Funk, super, super tough. But if I'm in a real fight, I'd probably want Meng on my side before anybody else.
I know. And I've got the told you so in my chat room, so.
Okay.
You've worked a bunch of people, but is there somebody out there that you wish you had the chance to have worked with or would work with now?
I always say they were running the program where David Flair was fighting against Rick, and I was David's lackey or sidekick at the time. So building up to the fight between David and Rick, I'm saying, okay, usually somewhere in here there's going to be Rick against the sidekick, and Rick's going to go up, and David will end up running in and beating up Rick. I wish I would have gotten that match with Ric Flair. It would have been an incredible experience, but it just wasn't in the cards. We met in like some six-man tag. It was me, David, and I believe Jeff Jarrett with Rick, and I think Kevin Nash and Arn, but it's I never got that one-on-one, and I think that would have been mind-blowing to say the least. Like, working Terry Funk at Starrcade was a dream come true, and even surreal to this day. Crazy cool. But having a one-on-one match with Rick would have been incredible.
So I guess I got a question here, because just kind of throwing this out there for people that may not know. When we see these ongoing storylines week to week on TV, it all makes sense. But if you're going to a local small show, how do we develop that story or have some kind of story or any kind of... Because if two people just show up and wrestle, I mean, I know that does happen, but it's hard for... how do we get the crowd on one guy's side or the other, I guess is my question.
Meaning independent shows, correct?
Yeah, the smaller shows.
It's really hard. You have to do a lot with body language, how you interact with the crowd. If you have a quote-unquote smart crowd that are up on all of the characters, they kind of know before you get there what their shtick is. But I had run about seven shows in and around my hometown a few years ago. All fundraisers, family entertainment type shows, and it was a lot of talent that the kids didn't know, that the fans didn't know. So you had to go out there. Some of the heels did mic work. If heels would walk down, and as the kids went to shake their hand, they would pull their arm away. You had to get into the old school body language of who's who. If you're doing more of a pure show or a more of a hardcore type of show and the fans don't know you, I guess it would be your mic work, your interactions with the crowd. It's really, really tough without the benefit of having established characters from TV or something like that. But you know, there's always the small, subtle things you could do. The heel usually comes out first. Baby face usually comes out second. Not always, not set in stone, but that's, you know, fans are kind of trained that way. And yeah, it's just interaction. It's really tough on an independent, especially if you have a crowd that's not familiar with the personalities.
Yeah, I was going to say, because, I mean, they're selling yourself, but then they're selling yourself in that moment. Has to be difficult.
And sure, and it also depends on what the crowd. If you have a smarter crowd, you know, let's use that term, they're not going to want to see all the yay and boo and, you know, heels yelling at them for no reason, stuff like that. They're going to have a limited attention span for that, where you may have more success with those techniques if it's a family crowd with kids that are going to interact with you when you go back and forth. You got to know your audience and who's out there. And, you know, kids seem to go more for the interaction, the one-on-one, the personality from the ring to the audience, where the smarter crowds are just there for the action, and they want to see the, you know, high spots and action and exciting stuff.
It's just
in my opinion, of course.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, that's you're the only one I'm asking, right?
yeah. True. Yeah.
Well, at least tonight. No, it has to be. But see, I'm just fascinated by. Here we are, 45 minutes into this, which means we have 15. Oh, we have only 15 minutes left. Man, this went fast. But I'm sitting here thinking, we talked about selling yourself early, selling yourself in the middle, not in a bad way, but. And selling yourself at the end, and all the marketing and all this stuff. How much? I mean, you got the physical side of this and the marketing side of this, but I'm sure that's closer to 50-50 than I'm actually thinking it should be.
As far as what? You lost me. I'm sorry.
Well, as you go through the years, like how much time have you spent trying to sell yourself and get booked versus actually just working out and just doing the events? There's way more. Getting out there and trying to get the next job.
For me personally, I've worked over the past 20 or so years, as I've said, for a handful of independent groups, mostly in Northern New Jersey. If you don't live in Northern New Jersey, a lot of people probably assume that I retired or I died or I dropped off the face of the earth, just because I was involved in opening a business, running a business, getting that business off the ground and making it successful while simultaneously having two kids and trying to be a present dad and a good husband. And my wife wrestles as well. That's how we met. It's kind of cool. But we stayed very local. We found a way to do what we love in a way that enabled us to get done the things we needed to get done in real life. So there wasn't a lot of marketing going on these past 20 years. It was just me and my wife, two big kids, as we call ourselves, doing something we friggin' love and very locally. And just recently now, we've had the business for a while. It's on very secure ground. We have a great following, a great patient population. Our kids are a little older, and we've kind of played around with this eyes wide shutty timeless thing for a few years, and COVID hits and I decide to play around more with it. So through social media, which we didn't have in the past, or we didn't have as much, it's enabled me to market us better, and it enables me to market myself while I'm on the toilet, so I actually have time to market myself, where back in the day you would make phone calls and leave messages and this and that, and it was a lot harder. Now you can text, now you can post videos. It's really a cool evolution of how to market yourself, how to get yourself out there, if that makes sense. You know,
I guess as you were saying that, social media has helped those things that you're trying to set up before a show too, because
sure.
You can reach the fans before the show, or
yeah, some of the fans that follow it can see what you're about, and I think that's a huge help.
You sound like the type of guy that liked handling the mic any chance you got. Is that true?
Actually, very interesting story. I grew up, and I've spoken about it a lot recently. I grew up, I was in overweight, kid that's was very socially awkward with a very, very bad speech problem. I couldn't get out a word left or right, and I usually stayed silent because I was embarrassed to try to talk. As I got older and got involved with pro wrestling, it instilled the confidence in me to speak like I do, and I got a little taste of talking with Crowbar, although it wasn't a spot for the character to be a talker. It was more of a crazy, funny kind of character like that. And just recently I started doing these timeless promos. And I get people from town that say, oh my God, I can't believe that you're talking up there, blah, blah, blah. Or I get people in the business that say, I've never heard you cut a promo. I have no idea that you were able to do that. And I was just never given the chance, or it just wasn't my spot to do that. So it's really an empowering thing. And it's really cool to come from that very shy kid that kept very, very quiet, to someone you can't shut up now sometimes, and I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. That's why I want you here, right? A good show for me means I don't talk. I know that's counterintuitive to some hosts, but to me, it's like I brought you here to kind of just guide the conversation through all of this. You mentioned that Crowbar character, and years ago, like I should remember this, I had Eugene, Nick Dismore, on the show, and we talked about his character, which... it's different when you see his character and then you get the chance to talk to him because he's well-spoken and, you know, you have this picture of him for all those years, but then you have this other thing. So do you ever run into that kind of battle where somebody knows you from one of those shows and expects you to be something different than you actually are in person?
I've done many interviews where I was told when it was done that this went totally not like I expected it to go. So I think a lot of people on some level see that character and they expect that crazy character, Crowbar, and not who Chris Ford is. You know, I think I'm well-rounded. I don't want to talk myself up too much, but because I'm also very much down to earth and I'm a big kid. I love Star Wars. I'm probably the biggest kid going, but if I'm needed to speak in a professional manner, I'm able to.
Yeah, I mean, nothing wrong with being a big kid, I don't think.
I'm a huge kid, man. I still have not grown up yet, and again, I think that's a huge part of being timeless.
You're doing good there. So where was your favorite place to wrestle, Abe? Wherever.
Favorite place to wrestle? I have to at least mention I had the opportunity to have a dark match at Madison Square Garden. You can't top that ever. But one of my favorite places on the regular to wrestle, of course, would be ECW Arena 2300.
Yeah, that was my heyday. Is that place as small as it seems? Like everything was like on top of you?
It's small, but I think bigger than a lot of independent venues. Like, I don't know, I've had independent shows in VFW halls and American Legions and stuff like that. So it's smaller than, you know, let's say the First Union Arena, if that's still there, or like someplace like that, or like the Garden or something like that. But it's, I think, bigger as far as independent shows go.
Just about the right size, I'm hearing, is what you're telling me.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
I mean, obviously you want to play the biggest stadiums and do WrestleMania and all this other stuff, but there's something to that smaller, more intimate.
Oh, of course. And just the energy and the fan base there is just, they're, you know, back in the day especially, they were just nuts. And they gave you energy and you wanted to give it back. They drove you to work harder and you wanted to work harder. There was a give and take there. And that crowd often would make you a better performer than you normally would be just because of the energy that they gave you, if that makes sense.
Well, no, because as I mentioned, I mean, I was an ECW fan, and to go to the same place every week and have those same fans, they were part of it.
Rabid.
Yeah, they were part of it. It's like WWE would move from city to city, but those fans in Philadelphia were as much as part of the show as the wrestlers were in the
big time. Yep.
Because Absolutely. They knew what was going on, and they knew who they wanted to win, and they'd let you know. And plus, I hate to say this, but I'm from Pennsylvania, so I can. They're from Philadelphia, so they have a very vocal opinion.
Super vocal, super passionate. Passionate is the word. Super passionate fan base.
So we've mentioned Timeless a few times. Is that what's kind of left here for you? As I mean, obviously, you've got a few more years in this, right?
Well, that moniker came up somewhere over the 20 years. If I can't remember exactly where, I did a small stint from Ring of Honor at a taping in Baltimore, and I had gotten a booking from Jim Cornette, who did a lot for me in my career. He helped bring me in when WWE did the light heavyweight division. He managed me and my independent partner, Ace Darling, on many, many shows. And he got me booked, and I showed up. I was in decent shape, and he looked at me for a second, walked away, took a double take, and he goes, "My goddamn, fuck, the Timeless Devin Storm." And that happened about, I'm guessing, 2010, 2011, and it always stuck in the back of my mind that, yeah, that sounds kind of cool. And fast forward to what I'm doing now, whenever I do an independent show, I ask to work with the younger guys. I'm not a veteran that's going to phone it in or mail it in, whatever you call it. I friggin' enjoy this. I like going out there. I get a charge out of knowing that I could take all these guys' moves. I know how to base for them. I know how to do them. I could still do a lot of these moves myself. Just from not having the wear and tear that a lot of guys had over the years, my body can still go. I can't say how many more years are left. I know that I can say I feel freaking great. I know that there's a lot of talent out there that I could tear it up with, and I'd be eager to tear it up with. So it's this Timeless thing right now, this kind of cool gimmick we're doing right now, and we'll see where it goes. You know, the business is on strong grounds. My physical therapy business, my kids are a little older, so that makes getting away a little easier. And I don't know, we'll just see what God has in mind for me. You know, at the very, very least, I'm the biggest fan going, and if all I do is do this on a local local independent level for the next 3, 4, 5, 10 years, so be it. I'm going to enjoy the hell out of myself.
So we've got less than a minute left, so I've got to say I've got two things, and then I want to make sure you get a second here. That was the best Jim Cornette impersonation I've heard ever, because I've been listening to him a lot, just trying to keep... I love the backstories, all this stuff. First, and thank you for coming to work at work.
He is responsible for Timeless, and I'm not even sure if he knows it. I haven't spoken to him in years, but I'm not even sure if he knows that he's responsible for this.
So Twitter, YouTube, anywhere else that we need to mention before I have to get out of here?
No, I just do at WCW Crowbar. There's a link to some YouTube videos there. I don't load them up too much. I have about as much time with to do Twitter, and that's about it. So check out the Twitter, and you'll know what's going on. You'll pretty much know what's going on at WCW Crowbar. I really don't have time for the Instagram.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Mauer.
The other stuff.
Stay tuned for details on saving money at the Duck Pond Shop.
Twitter right now.
I hope you enjoyed this. I appreciate you immensely. Hey, we gotta go. Talk to you soon.
Thanks so much.
Show, leave us some stars or a review. For more notes from this show or other great shows, check out Mauer.com. A reminder, the views and opinions of this show are those of the host and guests and do not represent any sponsors, affiliates, or any other partners of the Mauer Report. Now for your money-saving tip. Promo code Mallard at checkout of duckpondshop.com, where you can get your t-shirt, coffee mug, and other great products. That's promo code Mallard at checkout, duckpondshop.com. Until next week, stay safe and keep quacking.
Bruce Martin, host of Pit Pass Indy. Each week, I go behind the scenes of the NTT IndyCar Series and introduce our listeners to the biggest stars of IndyCar, which features the Indianapolis 500 as its cornerstone event. The men and women that compete in IndyCar may be the bravest athletes in all of sport, as danger lurks around every corner. They are able to look danger in the eye without flinching. That is why the NTT IndyCar Series features the best racing on the planet. Join me every week as we talk to the stars of IndyCar, including the legends of the Indianapolis 500, on Pit Pass Indy from Evergreen Podcasts.